This is Whitley Strieber, and you have made a courageous choice. You're listening to Dreamland, a truly free, non-commercial voice on the internet. And from 22,500 miles in the sky on 1.FM and the Global Star Communications Radio Network, we say it like it is. We take you where others will not take you. Dreamland, welcome to the edge of the world. Rick Strassman is with us, and he is, of course, the author of a revolutionary book, DMT, The Spirit Molecule, and was a sensational Dreamland guest. And incredibly enough, I've just realized that it has not been since 2001 that this major, major member of our community of searchers and people working at the edge of science and reality has been on this radio program. So, Rick, first of all, I would like to welcome you. And second, I would like to remind you, folks, that Rick Strassman's book was one of those groundbreaking books. DMT, The Spirit Molecule, was a book about a series of experiments he did at his university, the University of New Mexico, involving the use of a hallucinogen, DMT. And Rick, we're going to go far beyond that at this time. We're going to talk about the documentary that he's making now and his work that he's doing now. But why don't you first tell us a little bit about what went into DMT and why was it written?
In terms of my interest in DMT, it kind of sprung from an interest that I had that basically began in my 20s. In college and from my own studies, trying to determine if there are some sort of biological, you know, basis to mystical experiences. I was struck with how there was a great amount of similarity between people's descriptions of their experiences on psychedelic drugs and the experiences that people reported as a result of either deep meditation or mystical states, or even some of the reports that were coming out at the time regarding near-death experiences. So I started to speculate that there must be some chemical in the brain that was, responsible for producing these effects in non-drug states, but that was probably similar to a hallucinogen in structure and in its function. I began to think about the pineal gland as a possible place in which these chemicals might possibly, you know, be made. I kind of kept a lot of my theories to myself over the years. I went to medical school and trained in psychiatry, but at a certain point in the early 1980s, there began to be an interest in the pineal gland again in human beings, especially with respect to its putative, role in winter depression through the production of the pineal hormone melatonin. And so that appeared to me to, be a golden opportunity to begin, to look into the function of the pineal gland in humans. In the late 1980s, I ran a study on melatonin in humans, but it didn't seem to be especially psychoactive. So I wrapped up that study and started looking for some other putative, pineal compound, that had some more psychoactive properties. I then sort of stumbled upon this drug, DMT, and even though there isn't any, established objective data that the pineal gland, makes DMT, there's a lot of strong circumstantial evidence, and there is plenty of evidence that DMT is made in the brain and in the blood and in the lung and in a number of other, tissues in the human. So I started looking into doing a DMT study. It took a couple of years of paperwork and interacting with a bunch of regulatory agencies over the years, but I began that study in the late, well, in the beginning of the 90s, ran the study for about 5 years, wrapped it up in 1995.
And then you wrote DMT, the spirit molecule. And you had, during the study which was EPA approved, I believe the first one in many years of a hallucinogen that had been approved by the EPA out of fear that that arose from the LSD revolution. And you, what did you conclude from what, from the descriptions of experience that your research subjects brought back to you?
You know, it's a very, you know, it's a huge issue. And,
yes.
You know, the stories that the volunteers returned with are just, you know, were just unbelievable. And it actually, you know, took me a number of years, you know, to get a grip on the enormity of the reports and the implications that, you know, could be, you know, kind of implied from, you know, some of the descriptions of people's experiences on a high dose of DMT, you know, especially with respect, you know, to the natural occurrence of DMT in the human body in, you know, all people at all times, pretty much. You know, it might be helpful if I gave a little bit of background in terms of actually what the DMT study involved.
Yes.
Yeah, I recruited around 60 volunteers, and all of them were experienced hallucinogen users. The first, you know, series of studies was primarily intended to establish, to generate as complete a database of the DMT experience as possible in terms of its biological effects and its psychological effects. So we gave a number of different, you know, doses of DMT. We gave it intravenously because it's smoked on the street as kind of a minor recreational drug, but it isn't active orally in most cases anyway. And when people use it recreationally, they smoke it. And, you know, the most comparable means of giving it to people other than smoking it in a clinical research, you know, setting is to give it intravenously. And it's a very fast-acting drug. It starts working within a few heartbeats. And the peak effects occur within a couple of minutes, actually, and people start coming down within, three, 4 or 5 minutes. And they're transported into a completely autonomous, freestanding, independently existing kind of universe.
So it's a, and what does it look like?
It's extremely colorful. It starts off extremely colorful. The visual, you know, field, breaks up into pixelated kinds of shards early on in the experience, the first, you know, half a minute or so. And, you know, it's important to close one's eyes because it can be rather distracting. And so the colors get faster, more intense. Then people seem to kind of, so with the colors, there comes a kind of corresponding kind of sound, a high-pitched crinkling kind of sound, and a very powerful, you know, experience of an internal kind of pressure that starts off building in the chest, then kind of goes throughout the whole body. And it seems as if the body is no longer able to contain this feeling of pressure, and people burst through or out of the constraints of their physical bodies. and their experience for the next few minutes seems to take place in kind of a disembodied state, as it were.
In another reality or in this reality?
I was struggling with, you know, the location of people's experiences. Was it purely at their minds?
Yes.
Was, Was it purely in their brains? Was it this reality, or, you know, was it some other reality? So, you know, was it some kind of a psychological projection? Was it an imaginary realm of some sort? And, you know, as time went on, I gave a lot of doses of DMT, close to 400 doses over the space of these studies. And, you know, a large part of the inner work that I was doing at the time was trying to create an internal context, you know, to understand these experiences, especially in terms of the mystical experiences. But even more remarkable were the reports of people having contact with these, you know, sentient entities of some sort.
Yes.
You know, and
Rick, what did these entities look like? They were consistent over the course of the, in other words, they all saw pretty much the same thing, didn't they?
Oh, there is, you know, some range of the, you know, of the representational, you know, kind of imagery that people experienced. You know, some people experienced these entities looking like insects, like bees or like praying mantises. Others experienced them, you know, in terms of cloaked kinds of, you know, silhouetted figures. Other people experienced them as kind of humanoid. There weren't any grays to speak of, actually. This is, you know, one of the topics that we had kind of touched upon,
yes,
you know, in our interview, that there wasn't a whole lot of people reporting grays, you know, the typical small, skinny creatures with, you know, on the large heads and the like. Yeah, but still, the kind of, you know, relationship that
is it conceivable to you that an adjustment, if there were somebody who knew perhaps a little more about how the drug worked, could it be adjusted in some way to change to alter the way the entities looked? In other words, could there be a designer version of it that created a consistent vision of entities, do you think, or not?
I'm not sure, actually. You know, these studies were taking place, you know, before there was much interest in terms of the abduction phenomenon.
Yeah,
we started these studies in 1990 and completed them in 1995. And, you know, most of the volunteers didn't have much experience with, or they hadn't read much in terms of the abduction literature. They weren't really that interested in it, and I have to admit that I was not at the time either.
Now we're going to have to take a little break, Rick, and when we get back, we're going to get into this a little bit more deeply. What is an abduction experience? Rick's probably got some very interesting insights into that. This is Whitley Strieber. We're talking to Rick Strassman, the author of DMT, The Spirit Molecule. The first, and so far, I believe, still only person in many years to do officially sanctioned research or officially approved research into hallucinogenic drugs in the form, in this case, of dosing 400 research subjects with DMT. And, Rick, let's back away, actually, a little bit from the abduction thing for just a moment. And you came to certain conclusions about what they were seeing and what that might have meant. Why don't we talk a little bit about where you eventually wound up with this?
Yeah, well, you know, in terms of my studies, they were the first studies in humans in the U.S. in around 25 years, you know, to give these kinds of you know, drugs to people again. And a few studies have kind of, you know, taken up, you know, and continued with doing clinical research with these compounds. There was a study out of Hopkins last year, which described giving a bunch, you know, a number of you know, human volunteers a compound called, you know, psilocybin, which comes from magic mushrooms. And actually, there was a German study giving some IV DMT just a couple of years ago as well. You know, so there has been, you know, a slow, small resurgence of interest in these kinds of studies in human beings again. Yeah, but in terms of sort of my conclusions or the kinds of experiences or the conclusions around the kinds of experiences that people had, I guess, you know, in terms of some of the smaller level experiences, you know, as a result of smaller doses of the drugs, those were more kind of typical of the earlier studies giving people LSD and the like, you know, where people experience, you know, psychological insights, you know, experienced a lot of interesting, you know, perceptual kinds of things, you know, visions and you know, sounds, those kinds of experiences. And, you know, some of our volunteers had, you know, near-death experiences and mystical states as well. Those were the kinds of experiences, actually, that I was most interested in seeing if my, you know, volunteers would undergo the mystical and the near-death ones. And I was prepared for those and, you know, had some, you know, kind of a theoretical framework in which to understand them. But it was those, you know, contact experiences with these entities, though, that were the most common, actually, with, you know, in response to giving our volunteers a high dose of DMT, and those are the ones that I, you know, struggled with the most in terms of coming up with some kind of coherent or, you know, cogent framework within, you know, which to conceptualize them.
So you were left with a sense. You see, I guess what I'm driving at is this. I'm in a position of having had another world, in effect, come into my bedroom and drag me out. And it wasn't something that happened once. I went on with this for 11 years. And then when I left the cabin where this was happening, it just stopped happening, almost as if it was very place-related. While I was there, I often had groups of people up there, and we would have situations such as on one night, a little being, we had the house filled with running low-light video cameras, because I was trying hard to document this. And on one night, this little being came in through the window and woke up one of the people, then another person in the same room. They interacted with it briefly and tried to get it, told it to go down the hall because it would have then been in the low light camera range.
Right.
Then people in another room down the hall encountered it. However, later we found nothing on the videotape. Then later, the videographer, who was sleeping with his wife in the rollout couch in the bedroom, saw it beside the bed, and he tried to turn on the light, it was a classic little big-headed sort of gray. It turned into something with the head of a falcon and then disappeared, and he and his wife spent the next hour, it was early pre-dawn by this time, up awake and discussing it, whereupon my son and I, who had been sleeping in the woods because the house was so full, came up to the house and saw a hooded figure come out of the front door, go down the deck, and go across the backyard and dart off into the woods, carefully avoiding the trees. In other words, it was not going through the tree trunks, but around them. We observed that very clearly.
Right.
And when we got into the house, the videographer and his wife were standing up in the middle of the living room in a state of panic, because it had felt to them as if a wave of heat so high that they were about to be seriously burned had washed over them, just as this thing had left. And in other words, what we were looking at was a seemingly physical experience that didn't record on videotape and worked as much in the grammar of dream as it did in that grammar of physical laws, but wasn't certainly a group hallucination because of the structure of it. And I'm left wondering about things like that. And I was so interested in your work because it suggested to me the possibility
that there may be actually be something like a parallel universe, that there may be other worlds that are in some way real and alive that can we can interact with using perhaps psilocybin or DMT, and that are able in a limited way to physically interact with us. And I'm just curious about your reaction to that.
Yeah. Oh, yes. It's hard to really, it's hard to really prove a theory or to even, design experiments. In terms of that phenomena you describe, was there any kind of, physical evidence of the presence of this being other than in people's minds?
No, the only thing that was physically present was the person, the two people who I warned them in advance not to touch these people, these little beings, because you get an allergic reaction. And there were two of them who were all swollen up because they did touch it. That was it.
Yeah, but there weren't footsteps, those kinds of things.
There was nothing. Whatsoever. Nothing to fix this in the physical world in this particular instance. There was another incident where I woke up in the middle of the night to hear someone in the backyard saying condition red as I woke up. I tried to turn off turn on the lights. I had a big bank of light switches that would turn lights on all around the house immediately. When I reached for it, a man and a woman, not aliens, came into the room from the far end of the room from the door and moved across the room, immediately in some way overpowered me. Everything went black. I started feeling pressure again and again on the left side of my head, and then it ended. And I woke up the next morning. I found the alarm system all blown. In other words, all the windows were open, but the alarm system was still running. It was not triggered. And I had a lump in my ear. When I tried to get it taken out by the doctor, he diagnosed it as a small cyst in the pina of my ear. It turned out to be a little white disc, and it moved down into my earlobe when he touched it with a scalpel. So he didn't try to excise it because it would have involved dissecting the whole ear. And he then had a little corner of it, which we sent to a biologist at the Southwest Research Institute, not to a regular pathology lab, who observed that it was covered with little cilia. And this apparently was what enabled it to move. A few days after the operation, it moved back up into the same place in my ear where it had been in the beginning, and it has remained there ever since because I've been unwilling to deal with it, frankly.
Uh-huh.
So that's another piece of physics. That's a piece of physical evidence of something, but it wasn't aliens. It was people. But who were they, Rick? And
yeah.
Where does
were
this,
they?
What were they doing there?
You kind of wonder how they got there.
It wasn't hard to figure that out. I heard him walking in the woods. That's what woke me up.
Right. Yeah. Well, so those were real people.
Yeah, they walked up to the house and did this. They were real.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's still there, though. What did they do, and why is it? What is it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the kinds of, experiences that my volunteers reported, I kind of categorize as consciousness-to-consciousness contact.
Oh, great. Well, we're going to take a little break, and we're going to talk about this. It's very important, I think, because he's talking now about consciousness-to-consciousness contact, and on some level, no matter how physical this all appears, in some way this is real, and this is where I think we need to go to understand it. We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber. We're talking with Rick Strassman, the author of DMT, the Spirit Molecule, presently making a documentary about DMT research. I think that's going to be out in a few months, Rick, and it's going to be very exciting. William Henry is going to be talking to Rick in the subscriber section and talking about this whole phenomenon and the distant past and certain imagery from the past that he has shown Rick, and I think it's going to be quite, quite fascinating. Now, let's talk about this concept of consciousness to consciousness communication. What do you mean exactly by that?
Oh, I guess I'm defining it almost in terms of what it's not. It's not, any kind of contact in which people actually have got any kind of, any kind of objective evidence. There's no stigmata. There aren't any pieces of machinery or tools. There's no scars. There's no bleeding points. Those kinds of things. But, it's an undeniable, real, and the experience is, most of the volunteers who describe these kinds of contact experiences describe them as more real than real. There was just no question it was happening. No question in the completely unique aspect of the contact. It was very easily distinguishable in people's minds from a dream or from a hallucination or from an imaginary kind of a, mental construct. It was, in their experience, as real and even more real than them speaking with me in the hospital room at the time. So that was part of the problem I was having in terms of interpreting people's experiences as a, psychological event. Like it was projection, it was some kind of a wish, fulfillment in terms of kind of classical, Freudian psychology, or even a Jungian archetypal experience. It was actually happening. People were being approached and communicated with these entities that looked like bees or mantises or crocodiles or, mannequins or those kinds of things. There was an exchange of information, especially with regard to the human capacity of experiencing emotion. These entities, they were disembodied, and one of their interests in humans, seemed to be the feelings that humans experience through their bodies, which, as a rule are considered emotional experiences. Like happiness and love and sadness and fear, those kinds of things, on which these entities, as a result of being disembodied, no longer were able to experience themselves. That was one of the major elements of their interest in us. Also, they were interested in kind of, portraying a hyper, kind of technological universe in which they existed, in terms of machinery, in terms of spacecraft, space travel. They also seemed interested in, the welfare of people, either individually or collectively. But at the same time, they were incredibly powerful. They weren't to be messed around with. They could be quite frightening in their interactions with our volunteers sometimes.
In what sense?
Some people were, some people experienced, being raped. Others were being eaten alive or being hurt somehow. That was pretty infrequent, but still, the experiences were striking enough when they did happen. If people started to feel these threatening and kind of hurtful interactions, the most important thing, for them to do was to let go, so to speak, almost to stop resisting, because what seemed quite common is if people started to undergo frightful experiences with these entities and started, to resist, then the experiences even went, further downhill. So the important, element was to open to it, was to accept it, and, was to let go any resistance. In which case, you know, if the person was able to do that, the quality of the interaction would then, you know, change into a into one that was more pleasant and, you know, beneficent.
Now, this consciousness you speak of, where is it?
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Where is this consciousness, this other consciousness that you speak of?
Well, you know, at first I was thinking it was just purely a projection of these, you know, of the volunteers.
Right.
Or it was their brain chemistry, you know, gone awry. But, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking about it in preparation for writing the book. And, you know, especially afterwards, I've done a lot of thinking about the location of these consciousnesses. And, you know, I'm forced to assume or to believe or to even state that I think these consciousnesses, you know, they exist in a spiritual universe, in a non-corporeal kind of reality that's parallel, freestanding, independent of us. And in certain, you know, in certain circumstances, that we are able to cross through the boundary or, you know, the barrier that separates us from non-corporeal realities. You know, every night, you know, everybody experiences a small, you know, version of that when they dream. But I think in some circumstances, especially in terms of our studies these individuals got a high dose of DMT, that there was a more concerted and, you know, a more focused entryway into these freestanding spiritual non-corporeal realms.
So now these realms, you mentioned earlier that they were somehow hampered in the sense that they had an interest in perhaps recovering or understanding emotional content that they didn't have it themselves. And yet at the same time, they could be terrifying, even dangerous. And this seems like a kind of a contradiction to me, that something that had no emotions would be able to be terrifying or even want to be. It implies that it could get angry at least.
Yeah, well, I think what may have been, you know, behind their terrifying demeanor was to kind of, you know, in a way to experience human's fear, you know, almost in some ways, to feed off of it, you know, to absorb it somehow, as part of what, as a part of what they were unable to experience on their own. You know, so they weren't angry as much as they may have been acting angry in order to stimulate certain, you know, emotional reactions in us.
Did you have the feeling or have the thought ever that they were trying to consume, in a way, those reactions? In other words, they wanted to absorb these emotional states?
Yeah, I think in some cases, you know, there was one volunteer that I'm thinking about in particular, who always kind of entered into the state with with the experience of being eaten alive. And it was almost a, you know, sexual kind of being eaten alive. It was a very complex mix of emotions for him, but you know, it was definitely a, you know, feeling of being consumed, both in an oral and in a kind of sexual manner.
Well, I mention this because in the abduction phenomenon, there are many people who feel that a big part of it has to do with the eating of souls, that people's memories and experiences and the all of the emotions that they've had in their lives are there to be consumed. And one of the most powerful experiences I ever had with the visitors was that in a series of meetings, mental meetings, I had set up what would be a face-to-face physical meeting. And this was really scary for me because I was alone with this at the time. It was just a few months after I'd had my first close encounter in late 85. So I was very, very wary of what might be happening and not at all sure that what I was thinking was happening and what actually was happening were the same thing. So anyway, I woke up one morning, the morning when this meeting was supposed to take place, and I went down to the meeting place, and as I was walking down there, I heard something, one of these little ships that they had, which when they were stopped or idling, they made a kind of clanking noise. It was very distinctive. It sounded like a defective dishwasher. You couldn't miss it. And it was making that noise down in the meadow beyond the woods I was in. And then suddenly I stopped because it was just overwhelming to me. And I heard a terrible voice inside my head saying, come on, come on, so rough and so mean that it frightened me and I couldn't go on. And I turned around and I walked back to the house and I felt but did not see something coming behind me. And I heard over the woods three of the most poignant, ineffable cries, unbelievably beautiful. Sounds that remain the single most emotionally filled and rich sounds I've ever heard. I stepped into the house, and then I went up to my wife's, where my wife was, because I could feel there was seemed to be something in the house. And it was scary, and I wanted to be with her because I was afraid it would hurt her. And I went there, and then suddenly there was not taken from me but returned to me babyhood memories of coming out of the womb and of first walking. So vivid, Rick, that they were, I'll never forget them again. The childhood amnesia was lifted. In other words, the opposite of what we were talking about, not having a memory taken, but having an incredible memory given back. What do you make of that? Well, I'll ask you in just a minute because we have to take another break. We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber. We're talking with Rick Strassman. And Rick is going to be talking to William Henry also in the subscriber section. So don't miss that. This is really fascinating stuff. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. And Rick, I hope you don't mind my challenging you in a way with these things because I think you have a big part of the key here. And I'm not sure that anyone knows what it is, including you, or certainly not me, because there's a kind of a gulf between the scientific community's fear of seeing this as something in the physical world and our desire to understand it at the same time. And I think it bleeds into the physical world all the time, frankly, personally.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, the kinds of questions that our studies raised and your experiences raise, you know, they go to the heart of the matter of the interface between the spiritual and the physical. It's a very slippery kind of borderland there, you know. It's kind of the borderland between science and religion, which has always been kind of a, you know, demilitarized, you know, zone. It's fraught with all kinds of uncertainties, ambiguities, conflicts, theoretical, you know, crosstalk that's very difficult to understand, to make some, you know, kind of progress within. You were speaking about your memory as a child. There's this thing called state-specific memory in psychology. If you're in a specific or in a, you know, particular state of mind when an event happens, and you're not in that state of mind later on, it's difficult, you know, to remember the event itself. And only later, if you're in the same state of mind, can you remember an event that took place in a comparable one. So that's been kind of used in terms of explaining how people are able to remember things, that they did when they were drunk, if they are, in the future also drunk, or under the influence of a specific, kind of drug, or in a specific state of consciousness. So you may have been able, to have remembered those experiences from your childhood, because of your brain, being in the same state of consciousness, as when you were first walking, later on as an adult, when you were undergoing that experience, it was, an analogous state of consciousness, it's an analogous state of consciousness that you may have been in at, both of those moments, as an adult at one time and as an infant the other time.
That's fascinating because, of course, the memory was so vivid and so real and filled with all of the little minutiae that was in my mother's room at the time. It was amazing that, because we have such amnesia about our childhoods, that this could even be, and the strangeness of the birth experience, the sense of cold and these flashing goggle eyes, it was really scary. It was terribly scary. And
DMT levels increase with stress, and I've speculated that at the time of birth, which is clearly a hugely stressful experience, for the newborn, that there is a lot of DMT released. And if you were in, an extremely alert kind of, hyper state as an adult, during that time later on, as you're describing, there also may have been a large amount of DMT in your brain at that time, too. So that kind of, ties in with the concept of state-specific memory there.
That, I bet, is the answer, because, believe me, I mean, this, it's people on sort of outside of my life it's not possible to communicate the impact of these experiences, but it's unbelievably huge. And hearing that voice crying out and knowing that I couldn't stop running away from it, even though I didn't want to because I was just so scared, was an overwhelmingly powerful and devastating experience. Really, it was almost like leaving somebody to drown. That's how it felt. And yet, this being, whoever it was more powerful than I was by far, it would seem to me. Well, Rick, let's go on now and talk a little bit about your current work and your documentary and what exactly you're doing there.
So we're kind of in the process of, filming a documentary about DMT. There's going to be three filmings. One took place in New Mexico last month. There's going to be one in the San Francisco Bay Area on the end of March, and also one and there's also going, to be one in New York City in May probably. And if we're able, to gather enough, money together, we will try and do a, filming in Peru as well. It's going to be taking as broad a view as possible on DMT, both in terms of from the scientific point of view, but also we're going to be, very interested in looking at ayahuasca, which is a combination of plants from the Amazon, of which contains DMT. And
Terrence McKenna was, of course, very, very famous for his work in ayahuasca, and I know that you knew him.
Right. Yeah. He was, quite a you know, inspirational, you know, an inspirational, you know, figure, you know, for me and for the research. Well, yeah, so we're going to be looking at DMT, you know, both as a pure, you know, compound in the body and as a, you know, research tool. And also, we're going to be looking, you know, at ayahuasca as well. So we're going to be taking, you know, so we're going to be looking at it from the point of view, you know, from the perspectives of, you know, science, you know, biology and, you know, psychiatry, also from anthropology, you know, from religious, you know, sorts of perspectives. We're going to be interviewing you as well, you know, in terms of its role, you know, perhaps in the abduction, you know, phenomena, the experience of, you know, contact with non-corporeal, you know, discarnate spiritual entities.
There's a school of thought among abductees that it might not even be, first of all, whether or not it's a close encounter with people from another planet is something that seems far in the past to me. I guess it may be true, but I always think of it in so many different ways now. But there's a group of people who are very convinced that it's drug induced, that it was done to us, that it is not something that comes out naturally at all, or is induced by the beings, that the beings come about because of that we were in given drugs. And there's an undercurrent of this that says that because I published my book War Day and angered the Reagan administration, that Brent Scowcroft, I think, is the one they always claim, had this done to me in order to basically to drive me insane and to discredit me at the same time, which, of course, it worked in that I am totally discredited. I'm the communion man, Mr. Rectal Probe. I mean, I hardly could be more discredited than I am. And that seems to me to be an open question. I don't know. I mean, some of the most extraordinary experiences I had there involved human beings. And when I was in these situations where I was being forced to have sexual relationships with some of these entities, which happened quite a bit, often there were people in military uniforms in the room at the same time. So
yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? You know, I think you still kind of need to wonder who's kind of issuing the marching orders here.
Well, yeah.
You know, so who's telling the military to do this and, you know, for what reason? If indeed, that is a plausible hypothesis or not.
Who knows if it is? I mean, it's so strange. And, my own best guess is that there are parallel universes, that there is a reality, another reality here, whether it's a spiritual reality or another physical reality with its own reference to physics and to and to nature and to experience. I don't know. Or maybe there are many, many. Maybe the many worlds theory is true. Maybe we've spun off 2 or 3 million just by having this conversation.
Well, I think so. And, you know, people have been describing these sorts of experiences, you know, for tens of thousands of years. It isn't a new phenomenon.
No. No, it's not. And, in fact, its best focus is in the past, I think, not in the present. The best focus I know of is in the fairy faith of Northern Europe, in the descriptions of encounters and contacts that took place there. Those are very pure. And they are, I think, the business of the dancing in circles and the movement through time. I remember doing that when I was a child with a group of other people, other children, under the supervision of one of these strange gray beings. So I think, and you look at the old music of the lullabies of that period. Go away, peery fairies, come down, bonny angels, to our little room. I think that's a phrase from one of those. The peery fairies could easily be the big-eyed monsters that we see.
Yeah, well, you know, they're clearly our descriptions for tens of, you know, thousands of years of these spiritual beings. I mean, you know, like I've been doing a lot of study of the Hebrew Bible for the last, you know, 10 or 12 years or so. And, you know, it's replete with angels and, you know, demons and the like. So, you know, I think that, you know, kind of beyond, you know, believing in these things is more the issue of, you know, how do you interact with them, and, you know, how do you, you know, what kind of questions do you ask them, and, you know, how do you get, you know, prepared to interact with them when they do come your way. So in some ways it, you know, kind of boils down, you know, to some old, you know, fashioned, you know, kinds of things, like being a very good person, you know, being pure, those kinds of things.
In order to
be able to interact, you know, with the highest level entities in the most sophisticated way possible.
Now, why do you bring up in that particular way the word purity? It's very interesting because this has been an absolutely incredibly important feature of my experience with them, that they almost need this. You have to be very, very honest and a good person in yourself in order to interact with them. How do you, and I'm fascinated that you bring that up as well.
You know, it kind of boils down to the issue of inner work. I mean, are you a clean, you know, vessel? Do you have a bunch of egoistic, you know, kind of greedy, angry things going on in your mind? You know, if that's the case, those are the kinds of beings or the kinds of dynamic interactions that are going to occur between you and the beings. You know, if you're a generous and, you know, selfless and open-minded and helpful kind, you know, person, then I think the chances are, you know, are greater that you'll be able to interact with, you know, beings or be encountered, you know, by beings that deal in those kinds of currencies.
In that level. Rick, I would like to thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland. Rick is going to be talking with William Henry as well about the way this relates to the past. And as you can hear, that's a profound conversation. Don't miss it. Next up on Dreamland, Linda Moulton Howe. It's never been like this before. We are in the midst of one of the most extraordinary, if not the most extraordinary, UFO wave in history. And you're about to experience it firsthand from Emmy Award-winning science reporter Linda Moulton Howe, reporting on the absolute leading edge of science discovery and the true mysteries of the unknown. Don't miss her website, earthfiles.com, the one science website that tells you the secrets and gives you the facts the others dare not. Earthfiles.com. This week, are you ready for this? She is reporting about a very down-to-earth guy she interviews, a machinist who saw a gray floating in the air above him. Okay. Linda Moulton Howe, here she is from Albuquerque.
That's right, Whitley. And it was in January of 2007. That means this new year has started with a phenomenon that's been around for probably millennia, but it hasn't gone away, and it is appearing right up front and close and personal with a lot of people. Now, I had put out an appeal at my news website, earthfiles.com, at Dreamland, and in other radio broadcasts in the last several months for viewers and listeners who have had firsthand interactions with non-human creatures to contact me at my email address, earthfiles@earthfiles.com. I have received literally hundreds of responses from people all over North America and other parts of the world, indicating yet again how widespread and numerous are the experiences between humans and what appears to be non-human biological entities. One of the emails caught my attention because the date of the man's most recent interaction was the second week of January 2007. What he saw was a seemingly solid biological gray entity wearing a monk's robe type garment, floating above ground only about 20 feet away. Others in the human abduction syndrome over the years have also described seeing gray entities floating or moving in the air above ground. But this time, the location is a major defense contractor that builds armored vehicles for military application. And the eyewitness is a 27-year-old machinist who helps build those military vehicles. Further, the machinist had specifically asked to work on the all-night shift in order to get away from gray entities that have been intruding into his Louisiana bedroom and have given him night terrors. His wife has tried to cope with his night traumas, and she was relieved when he decided to work evening shifts at a plant that is so well protected post 9/11. This is a defense contractor. And that's why the machinist is haunted by the January 2007 event. He thinks it is a clear message from whatever these gray entities are, who have been in his life since he was 3 years old, growing up in New Orleans. And that message to him is, the gray non-humans will be in his life as long as the grays want to. Whether the machinist is home in bed at night or working for a defense contractor who has strict post 9/11 security. Here now is the machinist's description of his most dramatic childhood memory and what happened in the second week of January 2007.
When I was young, my mother remembers me talking about people coming, what I would say, come and visit me at night. And she pretty much passed it off as, you know, a child's got issues or, you know, just seeing imaginary things or whatever. And it really started out a few years later. We were grocery shopping. We were at the checkout line, and there was a book. The book was Whitley Strieber's Communion. I got real frantic when we were in line. I literally caused a scene in the store, and that's when my mother knew what the problem was. My mother and my grandfather, who is deceased now, both experienced this from, you know, their early years. So that she knew right off the bat what I was going through. She wound up purchasing a book and kind of piqued my curiosity after that on what I was going through, but I was still feeling a lot of fear after that. Most of the abduction cases that I can recall, I mean, I don't know what their agenda is, and I don't, you know what happens to me after a certain point. I usually get a buzzing in my left ear. It sounds like a real faint forklift beep, just a slight beep, 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 and it's in my left ear. I hear this. And usually, I mean, I'm a heavy sleeper, so my wife can tell you I can sleep through a hurricane. So if I wake up in the middle of the night, usually something's catching me like that, or that's how she knows I'm usually seeing something. I'll wake up, and usually I'll see a being or see a silhouette, and that's all I remember. This went on all through my teenage years, and after me and my wife purchased our house after we got married, well, I lived in St. Bernard Parish my whole life, and we moved to a little suburb called Muro. I just had a knee surgery. I wound up blowing my knee out, tore my ACL, so I wasn't able to walk, and I had to sleep on a sofa because I needed somewhere to stabilize my leg while I slept. And this is an abduction case that I do recall because it involved my mother. What happened was I woke up, I heard the beeping, and then I had a being sort of leaning over the back of the sofa, looking dead at me, and then I passed out. And now the next thing I wound up remembering was I was standing. It was more than just me. It was like, geez, there must have been 8 or 10 people. And it was almost like walking in a desert. It was like endless sand. I mean, as crazy as it sounds, but it was like endless sand. And my mother was there. And, you know, I look back at it now, and I find that's odd because I couldn't walk. I just got out of surgery. And then that was it. I remember seeing these beings there, so about 4 beings. They were about 4 feet tall. Your typical gray you see on, you know, television, large black eyes, real pale skin. And that was the only thing I remembered. But the reason I knew this happened was when I woke up, I had sand on my feet. And I had sand on the sofa. My mother didn't recall this happening, but she woke up with sand on her feet also, and sand in her bed. And she lived 7 miles away from me. So I called her up that morning. I was, you know, panicking about it. I was like, Mom, did you see that last night? She's like, see what? It's like, I told her the story, and she said, that's odd. I woke up with sand in my bed. So that's my only abduction case that I actually somewhat remember anything. Everything else, I mean, even to this day, when I hear something in the middle of the night, I'll wake up and I'll see something, and then I pass out. It's just because of fear or if it's something they do, but I pass out.
Okay, now let's go to that sound that you associate since being a child with these gray entities coming and taking you. And can you please describe it and mimic it?
It's just a real faint beep in my left ear. Just hear beep, 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 and it stays constant. And that I'll hear before something happens. Usually panic sets in right after that. My hair stands up on the back of my neck. I just freak out. And I know something's about to happen.
And you don't hear that beeping sound any other time except in association with the grays coming, appearing, and taking you somewhere?
That's the only time I hear it. It's weird because it's not like it's going directly in my ear, like somebody talking in your ear. It seems like it's just in there.
Inside of your head.
Right.
Could you please come up to this event that occurred while you were at work in the second week of January 2007 and describe in as much detail what you remember?
Well, at the place I'm employed, we're not allowed to smoke inside the building. So you go outside, have a cigarette, you usually come back in and finish your work. It's about 9:30 at night. Step out, have a cigarette. A couple of minutes after I got out there, I started to get that beeping sensation in my ear again. And the first thing I'm thinking is, all right, well, we have forklifts around here, so I'm probably hearing a forklift, and I just push it off. Well, right after that, I just had this overwhelming fear come over me. And I'm looking around, and I just so happen to look up, and I see something hovering about 20 feet in the air that's floating. You know, I just happen to look, and it's a being. It's a gray. And it's wearing this cloak. It's almost like a long trench coat. And I don't see its body, but I can see its head. And the rest of it's just this cloak floating up in the air. And, you know, I start to panic now because I don't know what to do. You know, I'm freaking out because I've never, you know, not in a type of facility like I work in. These people are prepared for a terrorist attack. You know, we have armed guards that patrol the facility. So the only reason I work the shift that I work is I'm scared to sleep at night because of these things. And what happens is I just get this feeling, you know, like it's not really talking to me, but you know, I just feel like I can't run away from these things. You know, it's the first thing that comes over me. I can't run. I can't hide. Just as soon as that happened, it floated up and disappeared.
How high is this being above you?
Roughly 20 to 25 feet.
And about how big?
I'd say about 4 to 4.5 feet tall.
And the garment that it's wearing, you said a trench coat, but earlier you said a hooded cloak.
Right. It kind of looked like a trench coat. I have a trench coat. That's why I'm using that as an example. It seemed like a cloak, like what's the best way I can describe it? Like a monk robe.
So more like a monk's robe with a head than a trench coat?
Right.
Now, what about the color?
The garment it was wearing?
Mm-hmm.
It looked black.
And the black compared to this gray entity's skin, how would you compare the gray entity's skin to a color I might know?
It would be like a bluish gray, like a real pale, looks like something that just has no pigment at all.
And yet has a blue cast to it?
Right.
Now, go to the face that you can see in this monk's robe cloak and describe as much as you can remember of the face.
Its head was clearly bigger than the rest of it. Its head is just huge. It has large black eyes, almond-shaped eyes, kind of slanted. I didn't see a nose on it. And it had, a slit for a mouth. Just typical of the things I've been seeing my whole life. Just a real large head with large black eyes, larger than a human's eyes, way larger than a human's eyes.
And it's above you, floating in the air. Can you see through it like it was a hologram?
No, it's solid. Very solid.
See, as far as you're concerned, this is an organic, solid being.
Yes.
but it just happens to be able to float.
I can't understand that either, Linda. Really don't. That's what freaked me out.
Yeah. Let's go to this possible telepathic communication. You've been smoking a cigarette, and you become aware of this gray being that has haunted you your whole life, 20 feet above you, floating in the air. And then what happens inside of your head, to the best of your ability to describe?
The only thing I feel is I just cannot run away. And it just seems like that's put in me, like I can't hide from it. It wasn't like a voice or anything like that. It's just the one thing that just keeps going on in my head is that I can't hide from these things.
Now, this is part of the almost lesson. You have been going on a night shift in order to escape abductions at night, and you're at work at night having a cigarette break, and one of the grays appears above you as if to say, it doesn't matter when you work, it doesn't matter when you sleep, we can come whenever we want to.
Right. And I haven't slept well since, to be honest with you.
And in your lifetime, you're how old right now?
I'm 27.
In your 27 years, with memories going back to age 3 or 4, if you were going to sum up any kind of residue feeling about what they want, why they're here, why they're in your life, what would that be?
Be honest with you, Linda, I really don't know. I don't know. I don't know what their agenda is. I don't know why they visit me or why they visited my mother or even my grandfather. I really don't know. I don't have an answer to that.
And what is the bloodline in terms of countries going back to your grandfather and grandmother? Where were they born and raised?
The Canary Islands.
Canary Islands off the west coast of Africa.
Correct.
Your grandfather, grandmother, did they have stories?
My grandfather, he was a man of few words, to put it lightly. One of the stories that I've always heard, they used to have people telling stories of this red fireball that would chase the fishermen. I've heard these stories since I was young. And my grandfather, the only thing I've ever heard from my mother was that my grandfather ran one night saying he was being chased by a fireball, and he passed out. And then a few hours later, he made it home. That's the only story I've ever heard from my grandfather. My mother, you know, she had similar situations. Even in our house, growing up, she's pretty much seen the same things that I've seen.
What is your mother's sort of summary reaction about these gray beings?
She's not scared of them at all. She's openly talked to me about it ever since my incident when I was young. When I saw the cover of the Book of Communion, she's openly talked to me about it. She hasn't gone out of her way to investigate, but she's openly spoke to me about it. You know, whereas, like, my wife, I can, you know, my wife knows what goes on, but she's very uncomfortable speaking about it. My father, he really doesn't say much about it because he's never experienced anything. Well, my sister either.
And in your work involves defense contracts. Have you ever been debriefed or warned about anything of a UFO nature?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all.
Whitley, I think the cover of your book, Communion, has been mentioned by more people that I've interviewed in the abduction syndrome than any single book that I can think of. And there is something about that face that you depicted that seems to provoke such a wide range of emotions in people who have had some kind of interaction with these gray beings. And in his case, it's fascinating that it was the cover in the store when he was young that sent him into a panic. And then in the years later to realize that he lived with this, but that then suddenly in work, in a defense contractor, exactly where he's trying to escape by taking night work, that the entities would make a point of having one of them appear not on the ground, but up in the air, which seems to underscore again, we aren't you, and we can be any place that you think you are hiding from us. And it also reminds me of one of the more fascinating stories that I investigated when I was based in Philadelphia. And it was a man who was living and working outside of New York, Manhattan. And he did a series of oil paintings. He went that far, a series of oil paintings about his interactions with a variety of types that included grays. And in one of them, and I'm looking at right now, that is in my book, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 1. This was by David Huggins, that is his real name, in New Jersey. And it shows eight different entities, of which some are in the air. And he said to me, quote, "These little guys seem to float down out of the sky. They seem to be able to appear and disappear." And he talked in great length about the sense that they were biological, and yet they could appear in the air above him. And as I share that with you, I'm curious if you, in all of your experiences, ever had one of these gray entities appear like 20 feet above you or 15 feet above you in the air.
Well, Linda, you know, what's interesting about this is that we do have an experience that's extremely close to this. And what it is this. One night when we were living in our old cabin, we had about 15 or 16 people in the cabin, and there was a very complex sequence of experiences and encounters with a gray in the cabin. I was asleep in the slept in the woods with my son because the cabin was so full there was no room for us, and we were relegated to a tent. For some reason, it didn't rain. I've never been able to figure out why not. But in any case, we were walking up to the cabin at the crack of dawn, and suddenly a figure, just like the one he describes, a hooded, small hooded figure, came out of the front door, went speeding down the deck, across the backyard, and then off into the woods so quickly that it was literally looked like it was shaking as it moved around the tree trunks. It could not go through the tree trunks, interestingly enough, and it was the same thing, precisely the same thing. I saw it, my son saw it, and then when we went into the cabin, it turned out that most of the people in the cabin had had experiences with it of one kind and another during the night, including the last experience, which was with a filmmaker and his wife who were sleeping in the living room on a roll-out couch, and he saw the thing, this big-headed creature, come up beside the bed, and before his eyes, the head turned into the head of a falcon. And he then turned on the light, because he was not expecting this to happen, and he and his wife stayed up for that was about an hour before or so before it left the cabin, before we saw it. He and his wife stayed up for that time, and as it left, they did not see it leave, but it left behind a burst of heat so high that when my son and I walked into the cabin, they were both standing up in the middle of the living room because they thought the bed was on fire.
Wow. And so, that was in 1986, correct?
86. No, it was a little later than that. I think it probably was 87.
Well, at least 20 years ago. And now what we have been allowed to hear and share today on Dreamland is from a 27-year-old who is now, right now, in January of 2007, dealing with what you and so many, how many thousands of people around this planet
have
for
dealt
at least
with
for 5 decades.
Well, of course, a skeptic would say, well, he read Whitley's books and made it all up. But, you know, folks, that is a mistake. Because it's a mistake to approach it that way. The way you need to approach it is, what did happen? And what can we find out? And the reason is, whatever this experience is, it's leaving evidence on the ground for us to pick up, study, and learn from. If we could, for example, verify in some way that this really happened to this man, I mean, I'd be hard put not to say that what happened in my cabin on that night just didn't happen, because it wasn't like people saw this in the group. It went from room to room, and I'm sorry. I mean, it was not a group hallucination, and what my son and I saw, we weren't even in the cabin when we saw it. No, it really happened. It does.
Yeah,
happen.
And remember, Jim Sparks had little flowers on the bottom of his feet and across the carpet, onto the windowsill, right out into the grass in his Florida home when he had his first abduction experiences, and that physical evidence was there, and that's what terrified him, was the physical evidence in his own home.
Oh, absolutely.
And here this man, working for a defense contractor, has an experience in which he ends up with sand on his feet, sand in his bed, and when he calls his mother because she seemed so alive and real, she had no memory, but what did she report? That she couldn't understand why there was sand in her bed and on her feet.
Astonishing. And Linda, it is so, all of it is so, so amazing.
Right.
Linda, I would like to thank you for a truly great report, as always. It's almost like entering into another consciousness or another reality to listen to your reports. But folks, it is reality. And you go to earthfiles.com in order to find out what is actually happening, because we live in a world where science, as we know it, has failed. It doesn't address reality anymore. But Linda Moulton-Howe is too determined and too clear-headed to do anything else. Get set for a great dreamland next week. We've got something really special coming up. This has been Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back next week with another journey to the extreme edge of controversy on Dreamland. Do not miss it.